Ladies and gentlemen,
this is the lottery we've all been waiting for.
It's good night, freaking Irene!
Let's get ready to rumble!
Time! And those have enough people, the fire truck out!
On this episode of the Fight Chase Muay Thai and MMA podcast, we are joined by Hensel Gracie Black Belt and pro MMA fighter, Nick Fiore.
So anyways, Nick Fiore, let's just get right into it, man. So how old are you now, 22?
23. I turned 23 in December.
Okay, so you're 23. You're already a jiu-jitsu black belt, already a professional MMA fighter, and... So what we like to do with all the guests is kind of just get the – where did the initial martial arts journey start? What sparked it? I mean, fuck, with you it could have been Power Rangers or something. I mean, I don't know.
I don't know, man. I always liked, I don't know, just, you know, movies and stuff. You know, I always liked fighting in, like, all its forms. And I always wanted to do martial arts. And when I was quite young, I think I took a karate class or a couple taekwondo classes or something. But like even as a little kid, I was like, I understood that what they were showing, you know, what they show in a regular kids class wasn't like practical. You know, I wanted to learn how to, like, actually fight. I wanted to, like, spar, even as a kid. So then I ended up moving to New Hampshire from Massachusetts. And when I moved up here, you know, obviously you move to a new spot. You don't have as many friends and stuff. I wanted to occupy my time. And there was a gym not far from my house. So I started off doing just, like, MMA classes. And I was hooked, like, immediately. I wanted to be there as much as I possibly could. I did just the MMA classes for probably about a month, maybe two.
How old were you at that point when you started?
I started, like, just before I turned 13.
So this is something that comes up that us older people talk about, is you're part of the generation that was able to start with MMA.
Yes.
Like, you know, I kind of started with MMA, but I, like, as a generation, like, I was inspired more, like, I wanted to do karate and stuff like that when I was younger. We just didn't have the money to do that stuff. But we came up at a point where MMA didn't exist yet as something to compete in or to train. So, like, you're one of the generation that is able to get into a gym that trains MMA and that puts everything yes. together. So at 13 years old, you discover MMA.
Yes.
All right, go ahead.
Yeah, man, it was great. You know, and even then, dude, I was like 13, 14 years old, like sparring, moving around and grappling with amateurs and professional fighters, you know. And then, so, like I said, probably about after a month or two of doing the MMA classes, I started going upstairs and doing jiu-jitsu as well. Mostly in the gi, and we would grapple still in MMA class, but yeah, man, it ended up being pretty long nights, you know. I would, you know, thinking back through my whole, you know, childhood, like, it's like, you know, or going through my teen years more, I pass up a lot of opportunities to, you know, go to parties and hang out with people and stuff like that, because I was just, I don't know. Like I said, since I was hooked from so early into the journey, I don't know, I feel like it was almost like a no-brainer. I just felt like I wanted to be dedicated. Like, it drew me in a lot, you know. It didn't take a lot of effort to get in there, you know.
What was, so at that young of an age, and it draws you in, like, what was the goal? Like, what did you see that you wanted to do with it?
Well, I mean, always the you know, obviously the UFC was always like the, you know, that was what I was like, man, this is the real thing, man. You know, so that's what, you know, I was kind of thinking, but I was also like, you know, because at the beginning I wasn't like, you know, totally set on just being an MMA fighter. I was just, I pretty much just made the decision that I was like, I want to make this my life, like training, teaching, kind of all of it. You know, I just wanted to be around it all the time, you know. And so the goal from even a young age was get as good as possible, experience as much as possible, fight, compete in grappling tournaments. And I don't know, I wanted to just be legitimate and then take all that experience and open up a gym eventually and pass it along, you know. And I feel like that's a lot of people's kind of journey with it. But yeah, no, I kind of just figured that out early on, you know. And that I was very fortunate to do that, which is why now I'm, you know, 23 years old and a black belt in jiu-jitsu, and you know, I've got some fights under my belt. But even now, I mean, it's been like 10 years and I still feel like I'm at the very beginning, even though I've crossed so many bridges. You know, I still feel like I've done a fraction of what I would like to do
in my
overall career, you know.
So what is your progression kind of like age-wise with your jiu-jitsu belts?
I was at each belt for probably around 2 years.
And when did you go to blue? So you went to blue at like 15 or?
Yes. Yeah. So, because I know some places it's like you have to be 16, but yeah. I guess we there was some distinction where they said it could be the year, the same year that you turn 16. Mm-hmm. Basically, my birthday is in December, so, you know, I turn 15 in December, and then come January, it's technically the calendar year I turned 16, so they essentially gave me my blue belt, like, that month.
Gotcha.
Oh, yeah. See, that makes sense.
Yes, yes.
And so, you're in the gym, especially that gym, more than anyone that I know of. So you fell in love with jiu-jitsu. Did you ever veer, I guess I kind of know you did, but veer more towards just jiu-jitsu and less towards the MMA striking aspect? And again, I know a little more of the story, so, but.
Yeah, so, I mean, I don't know. I loved them both always, but I feel like I had more training partners over the years, like more experienced people in the grappling fields. Still was surrounded by pretty good strikers, but I don't know. I was just kind of like drawn into the grappling because there's so much to it. And I was still, you know, striking the whole time. I was doing both, but then, you know, I kind of took the idea was that I was going to do as many like jiu-jitsu tournaments as I could while I was young, so that I would get used to competition. So then when I was ready to do MMA fights, then I would be a little bit better at dealing with the nerves and stuff like that. So it kind of just worked out like that. So more recently, you know, I've been doing a lot more striking. I would say probably over the last year, maybe year and a half, I've been leaning a lot more towards the MMA side. But before that, I was doing a lot more just pure grappling. Mm. So.
And so you run at Henzo Gracie's here in New Hampshire. You run the MMA program and the Nogi program and the striking program.
Yeah, it's like a fundamental striking program. And then most of the people that take the MMA classes do a little bit of everything. So we focus more on that, on kind of putting it together, strike to take down, you know, wall work, you know, mixing it up, striking while grappling, all that good stuff. And then, you know, I've been doing a lot of cross training as well. Because, I mean, you know, just like anybody else, I'm teaching classes, but I'm also definitely a student, man. I'm learning new stuff all the time.
Yeah.
So I'm thankfully able to work with some top level guys on a pretty regular basis. And Rob Font and Calvin Cater and those guys, the New England Cartel crew. So thankfully they let me get in on their sessions and stuff. We kind of trade knowledge for knowledge. You know, I show some jiu-jitsu, they show me some striking, and we drill and we all work together, and it works out well.
Man, cool. Calvin's last fight was insane.
Yeah. Ridiculous, man. Ridiculous. Man. Calvin, Max Holloway is as tough as they come. Calvin is a freaking warrior. Like, dude, like, I was actually saying this earlier today. I've never been tested like that in my experience.
Most fighters haven't.
There's very few people in the world that have. And all I can hope is that if the day ever comes where I'm tested like that, I hope, like, I'm a fraction as tough as Calvin Cater, man.
I mean, you heard they were saying, you know, why isn't the corner, you know, just throwing the towel and I get it, because you don't want to, you're not going to win that fight, like, but as a fighter, I'm sure you're like, you know, he never went down, so you're like, how are you going to give up the fight? You know, obviously, you know you're going to lose, but then all of a sudden, you know, your corners and your trainers are trying to look out for your health and your longevity, because you're taking nothing but damage. You know, every once in a while, he would wing a punch and land, but he was getting destroyed. But that guy never went down. I mean, it was insane. That was a hell of a fight.
Yeah, man, it was crazy. And it's always a bummer to lose a fight. But it happens. It happens to everybody. It's just part of it, obviously. And I think Calvin, like, I don't know. I feel like he gained a lot of fans. He gained a lot of respect.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Even more than he had, you know, and he's already a very reputable guy. But, yeah, man, it's you know, it's good. It's good that everybody is giving him that respect that he definitely deserves. Yeah. After that battle, you know, and it's like, I think you can't put a price on experience, and to go five rounds with Max Holloway is that's a crazy experience, man.
To go five rounds,
he's
not
only gonna get better.
Down.
It doesn't even make a difference for him, man. He's just gonna keep getting better.
Oh yeah, you know? Yeah, definitely. So what? Like when I started at Henzo's teaching. And I met you. It's funny. It's like, I went in to teach a class. You were doing the gi class. I don't remember if you were teaching that night out in Exeter. Mm. And I hadn't even met you yet. And you were like, and Nick comes up. He's like, you want to roll? I'm like, oh, I didn't bring a gi. He's like, oh, yeah, we'll roll no gi. I'm like, all right, cool. And I mean, I rolled with high level guys, you know, at Vanderlei's. We had fighters. I rolled with Kurt. Kurt's always kicked the shit out of me, no matter what. And it was like, every time you know how it is, if you have a training partner, is you learn kind of what they do. Well, obviously, Kurt would learn my defense to whatever the fuck he was doing and then switch it. I don't know if he's... You still there, Nick?
Yep. Okay. Yeah.
So, Nick comes up, he's like, yeah, let's roll. So I start rolling with Nick, and he's a young kid still. I mean, what, you were... 18, 19, something.
Like I was probably, let me think about that. Yeah, I was probably 18.
So, an 18-year-old, and I'm a seasoned blue belt. Like, I've trained with all these fucking people, and I slap hands, and he fucking wads me up, and I'm like, holy shit. You know, and it's not like, because you don't underestimate somebody in jiu-jitsu, but you also don't really think that somebody's just going to blow you away. Like, if you've been training long enough, you don't feel like... Because I actually had already trained with Tim for a while, like, when I was on vacation up here. So I trained with Tim, and he was another really good purple belt. And then I was thinking, okay, these guys are good. Like, that's what I liked. I mean, it was good jiu-jitsu. It was similar to what we had at Vandalay's, good pressure, all that. And, yeah, Nick just fucked me up. And I was like, oh, shit, this kid is legit as hell. And then for a while, we didn't get to train together. You had, you know, you were teaching classes opposite of me. And, you know, I had the classes at the opposite locations and things like that. So I had the whole, you know, I was trying to revamp the whole Muay Thai program and all that shit. And then when I started training with you in stand-up and started helping you with your striking, I was like, holy fuck, the kid's like, he gets anything that I say. And then I started watching how you would train jiu-jitsu and everybody, I was like, damn, I said, anything I show Nick, he can teach it within, like, the second time I show it to him. Mm-hmm. He processes this. It's just a different way to process things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's kind of like, I mean, I wish I was that way with martial arts. I'm not. It takes me a million times. But with cars, like cars, I know all about Lamborghinis and Ferraris. I know all these things, these intricate things, because it's a passion. And, you know, I worked on them, and so it was like I knew how to do all this stuff, and so I got obsessed with it. And is that kind of – you've told me before that, like, in school you didn't really give a shit about, like, shit that was going on, but you had – once you got into martial arts, you really excelled. And, I mean – I know kids. Kurt and I trained with. Remember the family that we trained with, Kurt, with the young boys that the dad pulled them out of school.
Oh yeah.
So we trained with these two boys. The one was he was 15 James? At the time. James. Yeah. And his dad was famous from back in the day, like. It is a weird story, and we would train with him, but they would travel all around, and James would, this kid would get to train with elite level athletes all the time, and he was really good, but you still, like, I don't know that he absorbed the knowledge the same way that you do, and it's really a very unique thing, and I don't know if you can pinpoint how you do it, but it's like... You can break a move down to someone that has no concept of how that move works. Mm. So you and that, you get that a lot from coaching, because once I started coaching, my stand-up excelled, and I understood so much more, so much balance and striking and all that stuff. So, I mean, like, what is it that helps you be able to retain this knowledge and to be able to excel the way that you have? I mean, like I said, 23, you're a black belt. That's a fucking accomplishment. You know, we always say, you know, you get your black belt quicker than you, or it takes longer to become a doctor. But you couldn't even be a doctor at 22, you know?
Yeah.
So, like, what is it that gets you hyper-focused that you are able to do that?
I feel like just interest. You know, if you're thinking about something all the time, surrounded by something all the time, it comes a little more naturally. But I feel like I was always a good, like, visual learner. I always understood, like, mechanical things well. Whereas I was always a very bad, like, auditory learner. So, for example, if you were to give me directions... If you're like, all right, go down to South Street and take a left until you're at, you know, whatever, and then, like, I would probably lose you at, like, step two or three.
I know. I've had you come to the house before. Like,
what's that?
I had you come to the house before, and it's only two turns.
I'm the same exact way. I'm horrible at directions. If I you know, don't see the path, I just hear it. Like, I'm the same exact way. It makes sense.
That's why school was really hard. Because it's a lot of talking and retaining that way. But then I started to notice when I would watch people do techniques, I could very, very clearly visualize myself doing the movements.
Okay.
Right? So then I would, like, you know, even see somebody do a technique without drilling it once. I could then start applying it on, like, resisting opponents, because I just understood it. Like, I don't know. I feel like my mind to body connection was always pretty strong. And I feel like it just helped me just pick it up quick. And there's exceptions. There's certain, you know, really finesse-oriented, fancy leg entries and stuff like that, that I might need to see it a couple of times, maybe practice it before I can apply it on somebody. But for the most part, I would say the majority of techniques, I could see it and then start applying it pretty much right away, you know. But, I mean, nothing substitutes mat time. So that, I think I would definitely attribute that, you know, mostly to any success I've had is just hours.
Yeah, you know? That, and you have that dedication, whether it has to do also, I mean, did you have any other jobs other than working at the gym?
Yeah, I've actually had a bunch of shitty jobs, man. So basically from the age of 10 on, I had a job, at least something. I was like a paper boy when I was really young, and then I would like, you know, I would do like just various labor jobs from, you know, raking somebody's yard to, you know, actually helping on like a, like doing like labor on like a construction site, you know, and then, you know, my dad owned a paintball field and I was working there. I was reffing paintball and stuff like that. And, you know, still training, but you know, I don't know. I always had a job ever since I got my first one. It was like just one to the next, you know, always busy. But now I've been teaching for, you know, let me think. Started teaching full time, like pretty much right out of high school. So, you know, the last like 5 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
You know, and I love it. I love it, man. It's just like anything else. I feel like there's no perfect job that you're going to love 100% of the time. Some days I'm like, ah, damn, like, you know, you're tired. You don't want to go teach and run a class. Especially because if I'm teaching the class, I'm going to train in that class, mm-hmm. you know. So it's like, it's not just very rarely if I'm like really sore, really beat up, and maybe I already did a session that day or have another session planned, that I'll only teach in the class and not do anything else. But it's nice. It's nice to just be around it all the time. You know, I'll take it over a 9 to 5 any day. Any day. You know.
So when you started competing, what age did you start competing? Do you remember like your first tournament?
Yeah. Our first tournament, I did a Naga tournament. Probably about 6 months into training.
Okay.
So I was like 13. I was 13. I don't even think I was 14 at that point yet. And I think I like won my first match and then got like killed. I got like killed my second match. And then I would just do them every now and again after that. Did a lot of federation tournaments, IBJJF, a lot of gi. But then, you know, probably the last 2 years I've been primarily focusing on no-gi.
Yeah.
And then, like I said, the last year and a half, more MMA-driven.
All right, so I have a question that kind of leads into something, but I don't... you were just sick. Like, we don't have to leave this in if you don't want to talk about it. So you let me know if you want to... Is that cool?
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay, so I don't know anybody else has had it. So you recently had COVID.
Yep.
And so, like, how did that, like, what happened? Like, obviously, you don't know where it came from, but I mean, like, the experience and all of that, like...
Yeah, so it was pretty much, like, I thought I was having, like, allergies. I would get, like, a mild headache and a little bit of, like, sinus pressure. Nothing bad. It really did feel like I'm allergic to like dust and like pollen and stuff. It felt like that. And then, one day I woke up, and I was brushing my teeth and I noticed I could not, taste the toothpaste.
Oh,
I was like, that's not normal. and especially something like toothpaste that has a very strong taste normally. And, and then once I noticed that, I was like, I gotta go get tested. So I went and got tested. Both my roommates got tested.
everybody had it. So that's why we were like, I don't know if I gave it to them, or they gave it to me, or whatever. But we did the whole, we quarantined 10 days. That sucked, because it's like, after training and training all the time, multiple times a day, nonstop, and then it's like, all right, now do nothing for 10 days. You know, I was still like, I'll go for you know, a walk or whatever. Like, you know, just doing stuff to stay moving. But, you know, that was definitely the worst part, in my opinion, was having to sit around. And then also I would, you know, get sort of reoccurring headaches like daily for a little bit. But it was nothing like drastic. You know, if I could still taste, I literally would have thought nothing of it, because I have a history of headaches, and it's not uncommon for me to get them every once in a while.
Yeah.
So, you know, then you just, you know.
Well, that's, and this kind of attributes, I think, to going to what everybody's talking about. We'll get back to the normal shit, but I just, it popped in my mind, and I haven't talked to anybody personally that have it. Is healthy people, this is kind of how it affects them.
Yeah, man, it's hearing different things from different people. Like, for example, like, within my household, we had different symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, me and my girlfriend were the only ones that couldn't taste anything, but my roommates could taste and smell fine. You know, I think I was getting more headaches. They were getting more lethargic. You know, it was like similar symptoms, but it's not exactly the same for everybody. And that's what I thought was weird, how it's like, we're in the same house, so we're not having different, like, strength, you know, there's like different strains of, you know, the virus. You know, I guess it does just affect the person differently depending on your immune system and your biological makeup, you know. So it is weird. It's weird times, man. It's bizarre.
I mean, you like, trained nonstop, so you're in good shape. I know your girlfriend trains all the time. She's in good shape. Like, if we didn't have a name for it, would you just think you got sick?
Yeah. Dude, like, I got way sicker a few months ago. I got the sickest I'd ever been in my entire life.
Oh, wow.
And, yeah, man, it was bad. And it was not COVID. They didn't even, like, give me, like, a name of anything. They were like, yeah, you just have, like, a kind of generic virus. They're like, we don't even, you know, it was like... But then I get COVID, where I have to quarantine and stuff like that, and it was like I said, it felt like I had like allergies. That was part of what made the quarantine so weird. Is it's like you're in this like quarantine, you're locked down, you can't leave the house, but like you're not even that sick.
Gotcha.
I just feel kind of crappy, but like not that bad, you know. So it is again strange times. You know,
so what did they tell you to do?
It's going
to
be like after, like, if at any point people start getting more like COVID vaccines and stuff and it kind of dies down, everything starts opening up more. Like, are we going to do this every time like something new pops up? Like when there was like swine flu and bird flu and SARS and stuff. Is it like, are we going to do this every single time any new thing pops up now? Is this the new norm? You know,
I don't want to get into all of that because that's a whole. But like,
I had a lot of time to think about it, so I was like,
no. I mean, I could go on. I don't want to do all that. But like, so what did the doctors tell you to do? Like, if we get sick, if you get strep throat, you get all these antibiotics, you get all this stuff. I've never heard anybody say, "Well, yeah, I had to take this vaccination or this medicine, and I had to get a shot." Like,
no, they didn't give you anything. They just
so how is it so bad that we're not even? It cures itself, but if you have pneumonia, you'll die if you don't do something. If you have strep throat, you could really fuck yourself up. But this is the worst disease ever in the world. But it'll fix itself in 10 days.
And it's just, yeah, it is weird, man. Because it's like one of those things, like, yeah, if you are compromised already and you get sick, like, it'll fuck you up way worse. But anything will do that. Yeah. If you get any other sickness that compounds on top of being weakened already, it's going to be worse.
Yeah.
You know? So, I don't know. I don't really know what makes this that different than everything else.
Other than, again, we're not going to go too far. Whatever the agenda of all of this is.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not an doctor, so it's hard to say. But just speculating, you know, it's like, it's just weird. It's so weird, you know.
All right, well, back to jiu-jitsu.
Yeah, back to the topic.
So, you started competing. Like, do you like competing? Is it thing? Is it, you know, you like the challenge? Do you just do it for the experience? Like, what is competing for you? As far as jiu-jitsu.
Yeah, I like it for the experience because it's like the ultimate test. It's like, all right, you've been working all this stuff in the gym. Now go try it for real. This is where it counts. You know, it's good to have it on your resume. You know, I feel like people like to know that their coach has like been there, done that, you know. And, you know, it's like having your dad there for you. You always have somebody in between you and the unknown, you know. And, but yeah, competing, I like competing when I'm in the match. Mm-hmm. I don't like competing waiting for the match because, you know, it's like an all-day thing. You get there at 9 a.m. and you don't go on until noon, and then it gets pushed back till 1:30, and then, you know, and then you compete once, and then you got to wait an hour for the next match, and it's just a lot, you know. So I don't like that element of it. But, yeah, man, it's definitely more of an experience thing. I do it for the challenge.
Yeah.
Where it's like, all right, put it to the test now, you know.
I mean, I saw that you just did that sub tournament at that new gym, and
yeah.
you won that. And so that's a cash money prize. Are you?
Yep.
You're more gonna. Would you focus more on those now because they're coming up like Submission Hunters? Mm-hmm. They just did one. What was the one in Vegas that they just did? High Rollers.
High Rollers. Yeah, like, yeah.
They just gave out a shitload of weed.
Yeah, pound of weed.
Joe Schilling just competed in that.
Yes. And that's, I think, funny. Jake Shields won. Jake Shields won it.
Well, I could see that, but Joe Schilling, yeah. I was like, you're a badass stand-up fighter. I didn't even know obviously you trained jiu-jitsu, just training with all the guys, but I didn't know it was like that.
Yeah.
But so it's like...
the prize.
What's that?
I said he just wanted the prize.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
It's like, count to weed, say no more.
Yeah.
So, like, is that stuff coming up on, like, kind of your radar that you could focus on doing those?
Yeah, I would say it definitely motivates me more to get in there and do that. And that's also nice because it's usually a little more organized. You know, it's not like the refs are trying to run hundreds of matches all day. It's like you're kind of, you know, one at a time, not as many, you know, there might be 12, 15 matches or whatever. So, yeah, I'd say the cash prizes definitely are a motivating factor. But now I'm trying to balance, like, training for what I have coming up, because I've done a lot of like training simultaneously, like, yeah. I'm doing MMA training and then I'm also doing like jiu-jitsu training.
Yeah.
And I feel like especially now competing against like higher level guys, now fighting at a professional level, everybody is getting better and more refined in that specific field. So I think it is tough, while possible, it's tough to be at like an apex level at both at the same time. So I'm trying to focus more on really honing in on one thing and then doing that one thing, you know. So as of right now, there's not really many, you know, MMA shows happening right now. But I've kind of been betting on when that one does pop up.
Yeah.
Getting ready for that. You know, that's probably why I'm not really jumping on the competition wagon right now. Just because when I do, I want to be like really honed in on the pure BJJ side of it. You know.
Gotcha. So like, what? When did you make your MMA debut?
I was 18.
Okay.
When I had my first amateur fight, and that was good. That was a long time coming because I actually did a whole camp. Made weight, and then my would-be opponent ended up passing out in the sauna, and he had to pull out. And then I was training for another fight, and I hurt my knee. And then I want to say I had one more opponent pull out before I was even able to get my first fight. So I have officially like 7 MMA fights. But I've probably done like 12 or 15 camps just because I've had guys drop out and get hurt and stuff like that.
I mean, even the couple of times that I cornered you is like we had the one guy show up that couldn't make weight. That's at an amateur level. It's so easy for somebody just to go, I don't want to do this anymore. Yeah. There's no money on the line. There's nothing on the line. They just kind of bail. So hopefully now that, you know, you've had your professional fights, it'll be a lot easier. Like, injuries happen, but you don't have people just going, screw it. I don't feel like cutting the rest of this.
Yeah, motivation to make it in there. Yes, definitely.
I remember sitting at one fight. Do you remember the fight where the guy called in and he was like, he was still like 15 pounds over or something at the weigh-ins?
Oh, yes.
It
well,
wasn't
that one
yours.
Was funny because I normally fight. I've fought at 145 and 155.
Yeah.
But, my normal walk around weight, I'm like in the 170s. I kind of move around, you know, usually around 170, 175, give or take a few pounds. But we were going to fight at like 170
because
we like couldn't find anybody. So, like, we were just like, fuck it. Let's just do this one, man.
Yeah.
And then again, the guy was just like way over and called in and like didn't even try really, you know.
Yeah. Like I said, I mean, you shouldn't run into that as much anymore. Getting opponents. I mean, we don't have the biggest pool of fighters up here.
Yeah.
And we just had Jeff on. We'll have that episode out. Jeff is the CEO of Tough Enough. And so we talked to him about all that stuff, you know, fighters that are not in areas that, you know, that are, have a great exposure. And, man, they pay for you when you get there. You know, you make an effort to get there. And he said, you know, they can get fights. And obviously now you're pro. But he was telling us that he just signed the Tough Enough, the amateur organization, just signed with Fight Pass. So like amateur fighters are going to be on Fight Pass now. And he's going to start doing pro fights again.
Mm.
So that's pretty cool. Nice. It's a really good organization.
Yes. Yeah, that could definitely be some potentially heading out there. Because I'm not opposed to, you know, going out of the way. But I figure especially when they have to fly you in, they're going to give you a tough guy. They're going to throw you to the wolf. Especially, like, I don't know if I, after, like, you know, with lockdown and everything, after, you know, like, a year of no activity, you know, I'd like to get, like, maybe one or two fights.
Yeah.
Get, you know, shake off the ring rust, get in there, and then maybe start, like, branching out more, fighting tougher guys to move up the ranks, you know? As much as I like the fight anyone, you know, anywhere, anytime mentality, you know, I try to be smart about it, you know, because it's like, you know, you got to be thinking about longevity, you know, and building a resume. I feel like that's what you got to do to make it to the higher levels of the sport, you know, because it's so unforgiving, you know, it's got the highest highs and the lowest lows. So,
I think I got to experience both of those with you. So,
I think so, yeah, you were there for me with winning a big ass trophy and getting dropped on my head. And
I remember we walked in. We walked in Kurt to one of his fights, and you know where he's going to the cage, and they had this fucking trophy that was bigger than bigger than us,
6 feet tall.
Yeah,
and you still have it.
Yeah, still have it. Yeah,
and he goes, we're like, that's going home with us.
Yeah,
we didn't even It wasn't even like we knew we that Nick could fight for it. It was just like, nah, that's coming home with us.
Yeah,
it was kind of jokingly, but it was like, nah. And then the funny thing is that trophy wasn't even supposed to be your fight for your fight.
Yeah.
But it was like you got like fight of the night or whatever it was, and they're like, yo, you deserve this. And so I don't even know how the hell we manifested that to happen. But that was pretty cool.
That was great, man. That was a great fight. The kid was talking trash online.
Yeah.
I remember he like. It was funny because I had the belt. I had the 155-pound title for a Premier Fighting Championship, which is more out of deep into Massachusetts. So the only reason we didn't like go back and keep defending the belt for that organization was because as much as I like fighting just for the experience and stuff like that, it definitely helps to get paid for your efforts. Because even as an amateur, like, I'm not training. I wasn't training like an amateur. Like, I was training all the time, you know? And so, as an amateur, we were only getting paid from selling tickets. So when we, you know, the fights are in Manchester, 20 minutes away from my gym, we would sell a ton of tickets.
Yeah.
Right? And totally make it worth my while, win or lose. You know, I would make a nice chunk of change, and it would, you know, reward me for my efforts at least. But then, you know, going down there, when we fought down there, we sold like 10, like literally like less than like 15 tickets, you know. So
it was like 3 hours away. There was.
Yes, exactly. So it's like, okay, so the day before we would have to like go down there and either drive down and weigh in, drive all the way back, and then do it again the next day to actually fight, or drive down, get a hotel, stay down there. And then they wanted me to fight in New York for like $500. And then I'd like to, but it just didn't really make sense. So long story short, this guy basically thought that I was just saying no to him, like, because I think they were trying to get us to fight.
Yeah.
And they thought I was like, no, like, I won't fight this guy. Even though I was just saying, no, we just probably won't fight for this organization as a whole.
Yeah.
And this guy, like, made this big post online and, like, tagged me in it. And all his friends were talking crap and stuff. And I didn't even say anything, but it definitely put a bit of a fire in me where I was like, this guy's going to get it, you know? And doing the conditioning and just working really hard, and I got in really good shape, went out, you know, worked my stand up a little bit more than I had in the past, went in, got the finish, and got a big ass trophy for it, man. And
nice.
It felt good, just the way it felt like the planets aligned for me that day, man.
Right.
It's awesome. That was good.
You're definitely determined. Kurt, you got a few questions, yeah?
So kind of one of the things, kind of going back to what you were talking about a little bit earlier, you know, like jiu-jitsu competitions, especially where you got to wait around all day. Do you have, like, any type of process to, like, handle those nerves before you go out there and compete? Like, do you have
I mean, I feel like everybody's a little different. For me, I find, like, I get, I try to joke. With guys around me. It's funny. I feel like, honestly, sometimes I gotta kind of lay off it, because I'll find myself like shooting the shit with the guy I gotta go compete against next. And I don't want to be too relaxed where you're not gonna go after him, you know? But I feel like for me, that always helped. Joking with the people just nearest to me, and kind of being like present, you know, just not being in your head too much. Just kind of leaning on all those hours.
Yeah.
But dude, I no shame, dude. I get nervous as hell before I compete, man. But it's always before I notice, like, when I compete or am fighting or anything like that, I'm wicked nervous. You know, you walk out, you're nervous. And then as soon as you, like, are, like, in it, okay, go, the nerves would go away because now you're actually, like, in control of the situation. You're not just like, oh, what if this happens? What if that happens? Oh, man, you know, you're not thinking about all that stuff anymore. You're just worried about what's in front of you. You know, so yeah, that's kind of my process. I'm joking. I'm trying to be cool, and then I just got to get there, and then I'm fine once I'm actually in it. You know.
Yeah, yeah. I'm the exact same way. Like once I get out there, I'm good. But before, like, yeah, I experience those nerves. I think yeah, that's real important too. You know, having the right people around you, because like sometimes you get that guy or like somebody that's not used to that experience asking you all kinds of questions, and you're just like, please shut up.
Yes, yes, just let me zone in, you know. Yeah, man, absolutely. And a lot of times, especially if I do a local tournament too, I'm most of the time coaching other people. Mm-hmm. So I feel like that kind of also helps the nerves, because you know, I like the camaraderie. Everybody's kind of there together.
Yeah.
Everybody's in the same boat. Everybody's nervous. And then also, you know, people kind of start to lean on you as their coach to, like I said earlier, you know, you're kind of what stands between them and the unknown. So, you know, I'll coach other people. I try to kind of talk other people through it. Just relax and just do your thing. Just do what you normally do in the gym, you know? You know, Professor John Danaher, I use his quotes all the time because they're just that good. He talks about, like, it's like a story about when he was a kid, the stuntman came to his school and was doing stunts, and he, like, walked across a plank that was, like, high in the air or something like that. And then he had the kids walk across the plank when it was on the ground, and he said it's the same thing. The rest is just like the setting is just like an illusion, because ultimately you're just walking on this board. Same thing with competing, you know, just because it's a competition, you're still just rolling with somebody like you do every day, you know. So
it is a really good analogy. Yeah, I follow him on social media, and I don't even follow him that closely, but every time I see something, I'm like, oh, yeah, that was really good. That was really good.
Yeah. His technique stuff is obviously second to none. The guy's just amazing. And then I love his posts online.
Yeah.
Like this well thought out, like, bit of insight that I feel like sometimes I read some of his stuff, and I feel like I got, like, better.
Yeah.
Reading it, because it's like, you know how, like, so much of jiu-jitsu is, like understanding, like, conceptually. Like, if you understand certain concepts, mm-hmm. it kind of takes you further than just, like, oh, like a set of steps for, like, mm-hmm. one technique. If you understand, like, a concept that you can kind of just apply, then, you know, sometimes that just takes you further, makes it easier for you.
Yeah, because you can apply it to so many different scenarios, you know, like, if it's just a technical aspect, it's just like, oh, just for this one move, but if you understand a concept, it's like broadly applied.
Yes, yeah, yes, exactly. And that's one thing that I feel like Professor Kevin Landry, who I received my black belt from, he's a Henzo Gracie black belt, and he, I feel like, did a good job at teaching me conceptual things. Whereas then, I'm, you know, you're kind of always studying the art, watching matches online and, you know, BJJ Fanatics DVDs and stuff like that to kind of get more of the pure technique, the more specific stuff. But I feel like, you know, he definitely gave me a good sense of concepts coming through the ranks.
When I started,
I feel like that's hard to teach.
Go ahead.
I was just saying, I feel like that's hard to teach, because it, you know, it's like, it's easy to memorize just the technique, mm-hmm. but to kind of teach somebody how to think, you know, it takes time.
Yeah. So yeah. When I came to the gym, I obviously still into my blue belt, and I remember the kind of the first time I rolled with a higher one of Professor Kevin's students, and he was there. It was at a health seminar, and I was like, "Oh man, I got health, Gracie, and Kevin's over here," and I'm like, "I'll just do my thing." I rolled with one of the guys, and I did well, and we were done, and I said to Kevin, I'm like, you know, is there something that I should change or do different? He's like, no, you're good at what you do. We're just going to fine tune it. And that gained a lot of respect for me because being training with Kurt, being training with our coach, Leandro Lorenko, Sydney Silva, we had a bunch of coaches and I built kind of my base.
Yeah.
We like hammered it in and we had a very MMA influenced, you know, style. And so when I came over, we had done things, obviously, I mean, just two different parts of the United States. And for him just to be like, it showed me immediately that he wasn't one of the guys that are like, well, you're going to learn Gracie Jiu-Jitsu or whatever the style, the 10th planet. Or he was mad. Yeah. He's like, no, you're good at that. We're going to make it better. And that's the things, anytime that I ever rolled with Kevin or had Kevin point something out, it was like minor stuff, but it was like, oh, okay.
Yes.
You know, don't do this there, do this. And that's how he always taught. And I would come into class when I would teach and, you know, do the stand up and I'd listen to him talk. And it was always just minor things. And it's funny because you teach the exact same way, and it's a very unique, precise way to teach. But like you were saying, you have to be able to teach people the concepts. It's like anytime I do something, because I have my set of things that I go to, you know, that work for me 90% of the time. And people are like, well, you know, I'll do something or unorthodox, and they'll be like, oh, how'd you do that? And I'm like, I kind of don't know. And they'll be like, what do you mean? I'm like, because I understand how your body works and doesn't work. Mm-hmm. I understand that your arm only goes so far. If I put pressure on it, you'll probably tap because you don't know exactly what's going on either. Mm-hmm. You know, same like when we started at the gym here started really getting into leg locks, man, we had ADCC world champion that was our coach that when he came in, he's like, everybody's learning heel hooks at Vanderlei's. And we were like, what? And we all learned leg locks and we were doing it for like, that was just part of our game. And so when we started doing it here, I was like, oh, I have a good defense. I know the mechanics of what hurts and what doesn't. And that's the thing, like you were saying, is people can learn the moves. But if I only learn the moves and you'll panic if you get in the position and you don't know what it feels like for a body part, like chokes are kind of, we know that they, when they're tight, but manipulation to joints and things, if you don't understand it, you might freak out. The counter to that is like a heel hook is you don't feel the pain before. And you haven't trained with somebody that's brought you to that edge that goes, all right, if I go any farther, you're fucked. Mm-hmm. And so you don't understand that concept, and then you get hurt. So it's like people, like you were saying, people do have to understand the broad picture. And like I always tell people, learn body mechanics. Understand body mechanics.
Yes.
That's like the biggest thing for me because I'm not good at, here's the move, A, B, C, D, E. I'm not good at that because how often when we train do we roll that you get A, B, C, D? You might get A from this and then thrown it at D on the move that you wanted. You know what I mean? Like you got to that position a different way. But what if you've only trained like how to get into a triangle from one position? Well, that triangle's useless if you're not in that position. But if you know how to use a triangle and you know the concept, you go, oh, shit. Maybe I could get it from top.
Yes. What do you mean? Like, you understand the idea of one arm in, one arm out.
Yeah.
It's like anytime you can apply that, just boom, you know, start angling people, you know. No, absolutely. Absolutely. yeah, man, the concepts, and especially because something like jiu-jitsu, where it has, like, so many variables as to, like, how they can position themselves. It's like, okay, their hand could be here on my bicep. It could be in my armpit. It could be cupping my tricep. You know, it's like there's just so many variables that to sit down with somebody and explain, like, every single one of those scenarios, it's like it would just take too long.
Right.
You know, but if I can give you a concept of, like, for example, like guard passing, you know, if I sit there and I show you this tight technical guard pass and stuff, that's great. But especially for like a newer person, it's hard to progress through the step 1, 2, 3, 4 in a systematic way. But if I go there and I tell you pass to one side and then redirect and pass to the other side, like that concept holds true, and then, you know, you start seeing guys redirecting the legs and actually passing guard that way, you know, even if I didn't show them anything, I just told them, you know. So that's, you know, that's very helpful to show people. But yeah, man, it's fun. I like it. I like teaching it for people. Yeah. I like figuring it out, you know. It's just problem solving.
Yeah,
that's all it is. That's why I feel like it. You know, for me at least, it always helped that I understood, like, you know, mechanical things. You know, because it is it's just logical, very logical. You know, I can't tell you how many times, and I'm sure you guys can agree with me, there's been so many times where, you know, you're in a situation or whatever, or you're having a problem with a technique, and you ask your question, you know, why doesn't this work? What can I do to make this happen or whatever? And you get the answer you're looking for, and there's a moment of like, oh, that's it?
Yeah.
Like, oh, that makes sense. I mean, I don't know why I didn't figure that out on my own. But it's like, you can't really, you know? You can't, it's hard to, there's so much to figure out, you know, because of all those variables and stuff. But
what else you got, Kurt?
So, yeah, just a couple more questions. Some things I like to ask, you know, the competitors on here is, like, what loss or setback do you think you've learned the most from?
That's a good question. I feel like I learned a lot from I have one loss in MMA. I learned a lot from that one. Not as much, like, technique-wise, but more of, like, what I'm looking for out of, like, a camp. You know what I mean? What type of training should I be? How much sparring should you be doing? How much conditioning work should you be doing? You know? Because it's, like, it is a balance. It's that balance. You know, so I would say, yeah, probably that MMA loss was like a really definitive learning curve. But yeah, lots of losses from competitions, you know, just learning how to be more efficient, fine tuning everything. So yeah, I would say I've definitely learned from every loss I've ever had, but that was probably the biggest one. And like I said, interesting that it wasn't just techniques. It was like everything, like what you want to be doing before the fight, what you want to be, you know, working on.
Kind of related to the last question, especially because you started out, you know, so young, like what kind of advice would you give somebody that, I mean, like, would be in your shoes, like that same age, like they're trying to come up, like what kind of advice would you give them, you know, if they were trying to pursue a career in jiu-jitsu or MMA or whatever?
Just persistence, man. Because it's like, I've had plenty of people come in and tell me they're going to be an MMA fighter, they're going to be champion of the world. And I'll never shoot anybody down. Like, show me you're going to do it. And, like, dude, I'm there with you 100% of the time. But I never judge anybody off of, like, that interaction. I only go off of if I see you there often, I see you just trying, just the attempt. You don't even you don't have to be good, but if I just see you in there a lot, like, that speaks so much more than just you coming in when you're all motivated and being like, oh yeah, yeah, I'm gonna be the champ. But it's like, that is motivation talking. You will not be motivated for 10 years. It won't happen. Right? But if you are disciplined and persistent, that's a long run strategy, in my experience at least.
Yeah, that's very true. I get guys coming in all the time and they're like, well, how soon could I fight? Well, you know, like, in my head, I don't say anything, but I'm like, that's the wrong question to ask.
Yes, like, yes.
You know, it's like, come in here and, like, train consistently for a while and then start thinking about that. But, yeah, I'm sure you get it all the time, too. Like, people come in and they're like, when can I fight? It's like, well.
Thank you once again for listening. Well,
if you're still saying this after you train.
Fight Chase.
Yeah, like, I don't know, man. I feel like people have, like, an expectation that you're going to be like, yeah, like, that's my criteria. You train for 6 months, I'll get you in the ring. It's like, dude, nah, man. There's so much to this. And it's like, Chase, for one, you're repping the gym. You can support us for right. You're representing this my establishment. It. So you're not just gonna throw anybody in. And also, like, and Kurt, if you wanna train for a week and go to a tournament, fine, go do it. But a fucking MMA fight is a real fight, man. There are legitimate consequences. There are physical consequences to not being prepared for something like that. So, yeah, man, my advice for anybody looking to get into it, get in. Don't even worry about how you do against your teammates and stuff. You know, just worry about if you learn one thing every day, just one thing, even if it's a very small detail, you just pick up one thing every day and it's just think about the long run. You know, think about once you start training, you're never going to stop training. Because I feel like those people that come in and they're, like, motivated, it's just within, like, they're thinking short span. They think, I'm going to come in, train for a year, get signed to the UFC, and be the champ by the next. And then I'm going to retire. You know, it's like, that's just not how it ends up, man. That's just not how it ends up. You know, so plan for the long run. Plan to train forever. Until the day your body gives out, and then, you know, even when that happens, your mind is still there to pass it on.
Yeah.
Keep it alive. You know?
Yeah, I feel like that's very good advice, because, like, you know, just taking one thing away from each training session is real good advice, because I remember back being, like, a blue belt and rolling, you know, with, like, purple or brown belts, and I'd be like, man, I'm never going to beat these guys. Mm-hmm. I'd always be thinking of that, but at the same time, I'd be like, oh, I made a little improvement here, a little improvement there, and then, you know, like, years down the road, like, actually, you know, was able to submit those guys and, you know, surpass them a little bit, and, it was just because, you know, I was just taking small little pieces at a time, and then over a long period of time, they all added up. So,
mm-hmm. Yep, absolutely. You know, it's like a drop of water a day, and then eventually you'll fill the bucket, you know. And that's the only real true gauge of progression, because you can't go based off of how you do with your training partners, because everybody's progressing at, like, relatively around the same rate. You're training with each other on a regular basis, so you kind of all know what you're looking for generally, you know. So I feel like the only true gauge of progression is just you versus yourself. So I always, like, coming up the ranks, and even to this day, because I get, if I feel like I'm not, if I feel like I ever, like, plateau, I get, like, antsy. I almost get, you know, kind of anxious, where I'm like, oh, man, this is not what I'm looking for. And I feel like if I can just ask, you know, a student any given day, what did you learn today? If you can give me one answer, just literally just one answer, that's good. Boom. You trained today. You learned one thing, you got better, you know, and it's really as simple as that. And then you just put it over the long run, like I said. Plan to do it forever. Because you'll never reach a point of, okay, I'm done. Like, my jiu-jitsu is perfect now. I am unbeatable. You know, it's just like, if you know, even if you do reach a high level, like, you can be a world champion. But it's like, okay, stop training now, and guess what? There's a guy right behind you, every step of the way, you know? It's so competitive, it's so, you know, it's just ruthless. It's ruthless, you know? But it's fun. It's satisfying. It's a worthy endeavor, in my opinion.
Yeah. Last question I got for you, is who, like, out of everybody that you compete against, do you have, like, a favorite opponent, somebody that you can think of that you just really enjoyed competing against?
Ethan Krellenstein.
Mm.
He recently got his black belt from John Danaher. We had trained before, because me and one of my main training partners is Placido Santos. You guys have probably seen him if you watched. He works for BJJ Fanatics, so he's in a lot of, like, John's instructional DVDs and stuff like that. He's a guy, yeah, there's all sorts of memes of him getting, like, strangled and stuff. It's hilarious. But he's one of my main training partners, so when they're in Puerto Rico now, but when they were in New York, we would make trips pretty often from New Hampshire down there to train with those guys. So I had the opportunity to I trained with Ethan before. And then I kind of last minute got into one of the Fanatics tournaments. And, you know, we were talking before. I like him as a person. And he's, like, excellent at jiu-jitsu. And we had a really tough match. We ended up going into, like, it was EBI overtime. So we were starting on each other's backs. So we went into triple overtime. And I barely lost by, I think it was like 12 seconds of ride time, like back control time. And even off that loss, man, I had like a lot of fun. Like, I was in the match and I was thinking, like, man, this is fun, even though we were like tired as hell. And yeah, man, to answer that question, I would definitely say Ethan.
Oh, cool. Yeah, that's awesome.
Mm. So, and then also Placido too, because that's how we met. We met at a competition. And then, like, a few months later, we were training together, and now we, you know, we train together very, very frequently. So
that's
cool.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Being that you got your black belt at 22 or 21? You got it before I came back. 21, right?
Yeah, I was 21. What do you think about that? No, I think I was 22.
Okay, so. A 22-year-old black belt. We say it all the time that, like, you know, because Muay Thai doesn't have belts and things like that. And a striker can stay motivated. In jiu-jitsu, I mean, you don't have this problem because you have long-term goals, but, like, in jiu-jitsu, we always say, oh, we're not going, you know, we're not training for the next belt. We don't, you know. Belts don't matter. That's after you pass your, you know, your blue belt, you're like, belts don't matter. Just train them.
Yeah.
We do care. Like, yeah. you do care. And you hold your belt in high regards. You know, I always kind of call it like you're defending your belt. You know, you're training at a level that represents that belt. So now at 22, you're a black belt. So you've reached the top of the mountain. Obviously, there's stripes and things like that. But you've at 22, you don't get any more belts. You don't have that next motivation. I know that obviously, in a grand scheme of things, you didn't lose motivation. But what does that do mentally? Because, like, you know that there's not that apple that you're reaching for. There's not that next accomplishment that's recognized by everyone like a new belt. How did that register to you, or?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it's funny, man. I feel like almost like as I progressed through the belts, it started to, like, matter less. You know, as a blue belt, you're thinking of getting a black belt, like it's like, you know, you feel like you'll have all the answers by then, I guess. And then the day, you know, I finally got it, and you're like, you know, nothing's really different. So it is, you know, just focusing on just, again, that one thing a day, the one thing a day. As long as I learn one thing every day, then that's all I really care about.
Yeah.
You know, and the belts, you know,
you get to watch it.
That is very, it's like, I don't know, because people have different intentions. People have different goals, you know, so it's like someone that's like casual, like a like what I would consider like a casual black belt, someone that like doesn't compete ever. They don't train that hard. They've been training for a long time, but they kind of just, you know, some people just, they just kind of do their thing. They run the classes, they kind of chill. They're not super driven. A lot of those guys end up being like, you know, like a competitive, like purple belt would give that guy like a tough run, you know? So the belts start to, you know, I feel like especially after like purple belt, like the belts don't matter as much. But, you know, as far as like motivation goes, yeah, I always feel like just being better was always like my driving force for motivation there.
Yeah.
The belts are nice. It is, it's cool to get the recognition and stuff. It's cool. You know, especially now. The thing that I was always excited for was actually to be called professor, because I always thought that was cool. Man, that's cool. It's like, you know, cooler than like, you know, I don't know. I liked it more than like sensei.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Same thing, you know, but like professors, like, you know, I always thought that was pretty cool.
I had never heard that until I got up here. I had never heard professor. We were always just coaches. Like we had like all of
I would say most people call me coach. Most people call me coach, but every once in a while someone will call me professor. I'm like, there it is. Cool. You know, that's what those 10 years before.
Okay. Right. Yeah. So it's like, yeah, like coach is just coach. Coach could be anybody.
Yes. And like, I don't, you know, I don't care. You can call me Nick. I don't care. I always tell people like whatever.
Yeah.
You know,
we called our coaches. Like in Thailand, you do call them crew or Ajahn, but
yeah.
That only means coach. Like, it means teacher. It doesn't mean lord, you know?
Yeah, grand master.
Yeah, it's just kind of, you're the teacher, so.
Yeah.
Anything else, Kurt?
No, I'll hand it over to you.
Oh, Nick, have you heard about Gina Carano?
No.
That she got kicked off of the Mandalorian show?
Really?
Yeah.
Why is that?
For some tweets.
Oh.
But they weren't bad. Did you hear the tweets, Kurt?
Yeah, I read them. Like, the one that... I can't remember exactly what it was, but wasn't she basically saying, like, they're trying to divide us politically like they did the Germans against the Jews?
Well, so what it was wasn't even... It really, like, because we had Kevin on, and Kevin's views, I guess, are probably pretty aligned to hers. But it wasn't saying this is what they're doing. It was a statement of, you know, that it wasn't the military rounding up the Jews. It was their neighbors. So, and it was that. It wasn't, look, this is what they're doing to us. It was kind of like a statement about the Holocaust of like, that's what happened. And like, I was watching something this morning and it was a Jewish guy talking about it. He's like, I don't like any comparisons to the Holocaust. That's ridiculous. But what she said isn't wrong. Like, she's not wrong. Like, that's what happened.
Maybe a bit extreme.
Well, with all
I didn't read the tweets
with all the things that are going, well, she also had some sort of Trump support at some point too.
Well, they got mad at her too because she posted a meme of somebody double masking. It was like something funny about somebody double masking, and they got mad at that too.
And if she had posted half of the stuff that Kevin posts, like Kevin posts like 20 a day or something, and the problem is just that weird cancel culture that's going on. And, you say anything that somebody doesn't agree, you're not allowed to have any opinion other than what the people that are canceling everyone have, which is really weird. Like, you can only have their opinion.
It's weird because, like, so much of, like, you know, it's like, America, you can, freedom of speech, like, you can say whatever you want, and everyone can fuck off, you know, but it's like, it's kind of not like that anymore. You really can't say whatever the hell you want and, like, not face a penalty for it, you know, whether they... you know, there's a lot of deplatforming people where, you know, they just can't get a message out anymore, you know, but it is a little sketchy though, because it's like, okay, where do if it's like this now, in 5 years, are they going to start arresting people or something like that? You know, that was like...
Well, they already arrested us, right? They arrested the guy that was, what, paddleboarding in California when this all went down. Like, they arrested people for going to parks. It's like, I get it. Okay. I mean, that... Again, I don't want to get into all the weird COVID shit. it's like, it's insane to think that any of this is happening. You can't have a conversation. And that's what was always the thing is, you know, we could have different opinions, and I have different opinions than lots of people. But I don't care what, like, it's not that I don't care what your opinion is. I just understand that it's a different opinion. It doesn't mean mine's right or yours is right. It doesn't mean yours is wrong. It doesn't mean you're not allowed to have it. That's racist. It's like, you're calling everyone racist.
it's funny because that's like the blanket term now. It's like if you say something that somebody doesn't like, even if it's like not what they say it is, if they put that stamp on you, you know, that's
trigger word. It's like if you call somebody. What I was thinking about is, like, once you call someone that, right or wrong, there's going to, especially if the media is doing that, right? So if the media says racist, or what's the difference between them saying racist or rapist or molester? All of those things are so bad that if they put it out and 100,000 people hear it, right? The next day, they could go, oh, we were just kidding, or that was a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
All the same 100,000 people aren't going to hear it.
Yeah.
So you still have people that are like, that guy was a fucking racist or a molester or whatever it was. Like, that guy did that, or that woman did that. Because we don't listen to the same shit every day, or it doesn't pop up in our feed. You know what I mean? So, like... what they're giving us in our feed, it seems like, you know, the funnel down of what they feel is correct. And I don't know why, but that's just...
Yeah, definitely, I don't know, all the media platforms are definitely biased. You know, they're picking sides, and it's like, pretty obvious. It's pretty obvious.
I'm ready to leave the country again. So I've been ready for fucking almost 2 years.
Ready to be back.
And so, Nat Wonder Girl just got her blue belt in Thailand. Yeah. DJ Jackson is their coach down in Fairtex now. And we just recorded an episode with him, and he's really working with a lot of the Thais. And that's another thing. It's like, jiu-jitsu is really catching on in Thailand. Gi jiu-jitsu even, which I didn't even think it would be gi jiu-jitsu.
It's too hot there for that, man.
Like, you will literally lose 10 pounds a session. So, so that was pretty cool. She got her blue belt.
Nice. Yeah, that's awesome.
Stamp got her blue belt not long ago, too. So it's pretty cool to see, like, jiu-jitsu going over there now. And you know, like, DJs over there, high-level jiu-jitsu guys are going over there. So it's pretty cool.
Yeah, definitely. You know, it's cool to see the sport growing, you know, all the time. It's evolving too.
Oh,
it's funny to see, like, the sport itself. Like, I remember, like, years ago when, like, you know, you could be a gi guy and then just take the gi off and you would do fine doing no gi. But I feel like now there's, like, a bigger gap. The you know, the style of jiu-jitsu is different now between gi and no gi. You can't just do gi all the time, take it off, and you'll do fine. No gi, you know, you won't lose everything going back and forth between the two. But I feel like it is like it's kind of two different sports. It's the same sport, but it's different, you know?
There's always been a different pace. There's different tools. So it's like it is an offshoot. And then with the popularity of like the sub-only tournaments and things like that too. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
It's bringing a whole different audience also. They have you're getting almost casual viewers to jiu-jitsu. Which is insane. Like, how many tournaments did we do that Kurt and I've been to Worlds a couple times and things like that, and the tournaments are huge, but outside of that tournament, like if we had gone to the fucking Denny's down the street, they don't know what the hell's going on. You know?
Yeah.
They're like, what are you doing?
Yeah, like the janitor of the building gets being held in, and he's like, what the hell is going on here?
So it's like, we got it in our jiu-jitsu bubble. We're like, damn, this is the best thing in the world. But now that they have people, and there's another thing that I talked to DJ about was like the characters that are coming out of jiu-jitsu, you know, to promote the sport, just like a Connor or like a Dave LeDuc or these guys that are just over the top, like Gary, and they're coming out of jiu-jitsu and it's revolutionizing jiu-jitsu. It's making people have an interest in jiu-jitsu because there's a soap opera-esque aspect of jiu-jitsu now. I hate that guy. Fuck that guy. I'll give you $100,000 if you can submit.
Yeah, people that are starting to sort of, you know, like Conor McGregor was obviously the epitome of it. But like people that start to sort of transcend the sport, where it's like they're at a super high level in the sport, and then they, you know, like you said, they become like a, you know, they're this character that, you know, is recognizable outside of that sport, you know? I feel like probably, like, you know, as far as jiu-jitsu goes, probably, like, Gordon Ryan is getting there. You know, he's pretty famous at this point in time, I would say, for sure. You know, but obviously, Connor, you know.
Right, yeah.
People like fighting. People like to
see
some punches getting thrown.
Yeah, so I mean, that's pretty cool, and that's kind of the direction that it seems to be going. Mm-hmm. You see a lot more of those sub-only tournaments for money coming up. That seems to be like the latest trend, and I think it helps a lot too because of all the shit, the lockdown shit. Those tournaments have never been big, right? Mm-hmm. Like the audience-wise, they've always been a pretty small venue. So it's still convenient to put those on, you know. Mm-hmm. Now that we have limited capacities and all that stuff, so that'll be pretty cool.
Yeah, definitely. And then with Flow grappling, you know, platforms to put it out to a lot of people.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Anything you gotta promote or say or anything like that, Nick?
I promote
your social media, and we will, but you don't ever post shit, so.
Yeah, well, the problem with, it's funny you say that. The thing about social media is, like, I don't know, man. I have a hard time, like, just keeping up with it.
Yeah.
You know? Because I feel like if anything good happens, I, like, tell the people that I, like, see personally.
Yeah.
I see them in person. And that's kind of it. But I'll get on it, though. I'll get on it more, man. Mark my words.
Unfortunately, that's one of the things to be recognized these days. I mean...
Yeah, you have to have an
social media presence. Yeah, and you get opportunities from it, which is really weird. But I mean, that's just kind of how we consume people these days. Is, oh, you know, you have stars that are getting free cars and shit, you know, but they're only like a TikTok star or something weird.
Yeah, yeah. You get freaking what's that guy, Logan Paul and like Jake Paul and stuff like that are just like goofy guys online, and then
I mean, those guys, like, they know they're not fighters, but they're gonna fight fighters. It's like,
yeah,
you're professional boxing and all that shit, you know, just because you've hyped it up, but you have an audience to draw to make that money. Obviously, don't go that route. But anyways,
have any of you guys seen that documentary Fake Famous?
No,
the one about Japan.
Nah, it's like they get a bunch of people and they basically just buy them a bunch of followers. And, like, I think it's, like, five people and, like, a couple of them actually become pretty famous, like, not being anybody. Just, like, other people see that they have a lot of followers and then companies start giving them free stuff. So they're like, oh, this guy must know what he's talking about.
That's what it is. It's so generated. And that's, like, how they talk about the music industry with plants in the music industry now, too. Is they build a character and they put them into a certain aspect of music that they want to have an influence in, and then that character gets popular, they'll buy them a bunch of like followers and things like that. So now they're famous, and then they can promote whatever product that was already the agenda of that person. It's really weird. Mm-hmm. But you said that. I watched a documentary on becoming famous because in Japan, they have a culture of white people being famous, just going to Japan to be famous. That's it. Mm-hmm. Like, that's what you go there to do. And so these guys, the Australian, I think they were. I think they were Australian. So they go there, right? And it's three guys, and they pick their dorkiest, like, weirdest-looking friend. And they're like, we're going to make him famous. And so they moved to Japan, and within, like, a month, he was in commercials because he was just a white guy. And then he was real weird-looking. And then he was in movies, like, just from... He went to this random casting agency, and they were like, well, yeah, we take care of, you know, white foreigners, and we put them in things. And so, like, his first thing was, like, some ad, and he was just a guy. And then he was in, like, a TV series, and then he was on, like, billboards and commercials and shit. And so they were there for 2 years, and he kind of became famous. And then they were, like, going through the whole process of how do you make someone famous, and he created this fucking character where he would be like in a sumo diaper and then had this weird thing on his head, and he would go out in public and they would take pictures. It was really weird, but that was like, they showed that you can become famous just by doing weird shit.
Like, as long as you're present.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. No. If you're posting consistently, that's what, like, because I get it all the time is like on Instagram or anytime you talk to like an influencer, you have to be consistent. You have to be posting this many times a day. You have to post this time a day. It's like, goddamn, that's a whole other job. Now, I understand that's why people have jobs of social media managers. So that's a whole other fucking thing to do.
Yes. It's pretty cool.
But yeah, anyways, man. All right, Nick, so, I don't want to hold you up too much longer. It's been good talking to you, and I'm sure I'll see you soon. But
yeah, we'll get some work in shortly. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, of course. It was awesome.
Like, shout out to
anybody.
Know, Gracie, New Hampshire, all the guys over at that gym, New England Cartel, Haverhill Inner City Boxing. You know, I got a lot of great guys that I've been able to cross train with. And yeah, and hey, Mom, you watch this.
Here she it has is. To watch it. Yes. Your mom's your biggest supporter now. Come on, I know that.
Yes, it 100% is. So,
that's awesome. Sweet. All right, so
thanks for coming on, guys.
Thank all you, right, man. Thank you. I'll talk to you later.
All right, sounds good.
All right, bye, buddy.
Thank you once again for listening to the number one combat sports podcast, the Fight Chase Muay Thai and MMA podcast. You can follow us on Fight Chase on all the social media, YouTube, Instagram, Facebook, all that good stuff. And also, don't forget you can support us at any time going to the anchor.fm/fightchase, hit the support icon, and you can support us for as little as 99 cents a month. We truly appreciate it. Thank you for listening. And Kurt, don't say boom.
Boom.
Hey guys, Kelly from Fight Chase. So today what I want to talk to you guys about is Project 52. Project 52 is a new project that I'm going to embark on, hopefully July, August type of time when I get back over to Thailand. So most of you have known I left Las Vegas, came to New Hampshire, and then was basically living in Thailand. Came back for some visa stuff to the States, and COVID hit. So now here we are, over a year later, and we're just waiting for the travel restrictions and things like that to kind of ease back so I can get back to Thailand. But today we're talking about Project 52. Project 52 is something that I have dreamt up that I want to do, and I want to do with all of you. And what it is there's 52 weeks in a year, and I'm going to visit 52 gyms in 1 year. So what I'm going to do is one gym a week for 1 year. These are 52 different locations all over Thailand. I want to go up north. I want to visit some gyms that people may have never heard of. There's so many gyms that people have never heard of. So I want to go to, I'll bring you to the big gyms. I'll bring you to the small gyms, gyms that maybe no one's ever seen. I'll just do these research and find these gyms and bring you guys to that. So this is a project that obviously I can't do on my own, as far as I'm going to be doing all the recording, all the editing, all of the research, scheduling, traveling, all of this on my own. The only thing that I'm going to need you guys to do, other than enjoy all the content, is the financial part. And if I had the money, honestly, I would just do it on my own. So I've set up a few different things that if somebody wants to help back this and kind of join in on the journey, is we have t-shirts. T-shirts really don't do much as far as put too much in the money. If you buy a t-shirt, I believe I make probably $5, but that $5 is appreciated. It'll go right into the fund for the project. While I'm doing this whole project, I'll be doing writing an ebook on the travel, on the experience, and probably on maybe all the gyms and then section them. I'm not sure exactly how that's gonna go. So again, that'll be one of the products that's gonna come out of this. I'm going to be doing I'm looking over here, I apologize, it's where my notes are. I'm going to be doing a video of the training from each gym, just like I do now, but this is 52 gyms weekly content will be put out. So if I go to a new gym, you'll have a new video of the gym, kind of a tour of the gym. You'll have a new video of the training at the gym. You'll have more artistic line photos with my nice DSLR. I'm going to take photos of each location. You've seen some of the gyms that I've done, and I did it at Some Arts Gym. I did it at 13 Coins. I've done some at Fairtex, like real nice high resolution, kind of more artsy type photos that people can enjoy, like Instagram looking photos. So you'll have a weekly journey recap. So it'll be me talking about how I got to these places. If you ever travel around Southeast Asia, you sometimes will get into cabs or a bus or a specific kind of vehicle to get somewhere that's not really known to other people. So it's part of the journey. I rode a bus in Cambodia that had no seats. They had bunks, and it was like an overnight bus. And after I rode it, everyone was like, "Oh, that's super dangerous." And I'm like, "What?" It wasn't very comfortable either. So like I said, we have the shirts. They're available through fightchase.com shop, and it's Project 52 shirts. Obviously, any of the other shirts there, they also will benefit this project, because this is where all my money's going to go. I'm going to be doing a Patreon. It's already set up. So the Patreon, you have different levels of support, anywhere from $10 up to, and it's a monthly subscription, so you'd be paying, you know, that amount of money going towards the project monthly. I also want to do a GoFundMe, kind of to get the project known, and you'll be able to donate there. like a one-time thing. The Patreon is an overtime thing, and there's different tiers, and the different tiers give you different things. Like, there's a tier that you'll get a t-shirt, there's a tier that your name will be in the credits to all the videos, there's a tier that you're the main sponsor, then you basically, your brand company, and or if it was an individual person, would be marketed alongside of Fight Chase as the journey would be brought to you by them. Like, kind of think of it similar as like if an athlete was sponsored by Nike, you know, their main sponsor, and that's who's giving them the financial backing to embark on their journey. So that's kind of the financial steps as far as I have figured out so far. All of these will be set up, like I said, the Patreon setup. We have Venmo and all that stuff, so if you get it, you just wanted to kind of donate a few bucks or something like that, that you could send that over to me, and you know, it goes directly to this fund. This fund isn't going to be used to anything else other than making this 52 gyms in 1 year, 52 weeks, a success. Another thing that we'll be doing as we as a me, but if you help donate, you're part of this project. You're going to embark on this experience with me. You could even dictate kind of where you want to see next. If I'm in a certain region, if you heard of a certain gym, like, hey, can you try this? Another thing that I want to do, I have a lot of friends now. I have a lot of friends in the industry. I have a lot of fighter friends. I have a lot of friends that go on vacation to Thailand. They're like, oh, I'm going to go for the Muay Thai holiday. Great. Hit me up. You can become part of this project. You will be with me. I'll take you to a gym. We'll record the whole thing. You'll be a special guest. I'm going to have some of my friends that are there, athletes, fighters, and things like that, join me on these things. So you'll have a different point of view. You can have me as a trainer from the States, as a enthusiast, my point of view of the gym, and then you could have in the same episode, a UFC athlete, their point of view of the gym. So it's gonna be kind of like a whole series. I mean, this is 52 weeks. 52 weeks is more than most of your TV shows will put out episodes weekly. That we'll be putting this content out. Along with your help. So I'm trying to. Anything else? I apologize. But I'm just trying to speak and let you guys know exactly what I'm trying to do. So you've seen a couple of posts that I've had up about Project 52. This is Project 52. Me, back in Thailand, 52 gyms, 52 weeks. Okay? 1 year of training. That's it. Now, you get to watch it. You get to have a say on where we go. You get to enjoy the experience. You get to see the ups and downs. There's going to be possibly injuries and sicknesses, or who knows? You know, it's a crazy adventure. All of this will be put out in video content weekly. And, you know, this is something that I like to do. The reason I started Fight Chase is to get people to understand that getting over to like Thailand or wherever your ideal destination is, it's not that hard. When we talk about Thailand, like on the podcast, so I started Fight Chase after a few trips over to Thailand, and Fight Chase was fightchase.com. If you've gone there, that's just my gym reviews, product reviews, where I came from. It's kind of like the epicenter of Fight Chase. And then I've started the brand. So we have Fight Chase Shop. So that's just where you can get merchandise like this. Ooh, if you know this logo, shame on you. That's okay. I know it too. And all sorts of different, like, cool martial arts type of shirts and things like that. I have hoodies. And these are all designed by me. I come up with the designs. I figure them out. I've learned Photoshop, same as I've learned all my editing for doing the YouTube channel. Learned how to edit all the videos, and that's gone over to the podcast. We've had amazing guests on the podcast. If you haven't listened to the Fight Chase podcast, check that out. We've had John Wayne Parr, Khalil Roundtree Jr., Who do we just had? I mean, we have so many episodes that I haven't even put out yet. They're amazing fighters, and I have DJ Jackson. I have Mark Matthews from Ink Master. I have Savas Michael from One Championship. We have so many people coming up, and we've had so many amazing episodes already out. So check those out. But I learned how now we're putting out videos with those, okay? So I've learned that aspect of it. And what I do with all this is I just want to give you information to help you maybe take a step to make a journey to see that we need to be out and we need to experience things. You need to meet new people, experience cultures, travel. Like, we're not made just to do the 9-to-5 and be stuck in your house like we have been. So they couldn't think of a better time to really go for this ambitious project. Is as soon as I'm able to travel, to be out of this situation again and back into where I'm the happiest in Thailand, I want to bring all of you with me. I want to bring everyone with me. If you don't even help support this financially, please just join the journey. But this video is just me trying to show you the passion that I have, explain the journey, what we're going to have to do to make it happen. Got to make some money, unfortunately. But people get money to play video games on TV. So I was hoping that we can make this get rolling. I have a few businesses that are looking to come on board. I mean, I've always had great hope product-wise with like Defense Soap. And a few other brands that have kind of given me product support. So this is going to be a big thing. That it's going to be a financial thing. All of my money is going to go to it for the next year to make it happen. And, you know, that's what it is. Project 52, guys. Let's get it happening. If you come to Thailand, you're part of the show. If you're at home, you're enjoying the show. So thanks, you guys, for listening. Hope you understand how much this means to me. And let's make it happen. Have a great day.